They are Mexican cartels and criminals.
Now the cartels are getting their hands on the
head. Head of the Sinaloa cartel.
This is the second part of the interview with Osvaldo Zavala, professor of contemporary Latin American literature and culture at the City University of New York. In this episode, Osvaldo reflects on the continuities and changes that Mexico has experienced under President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. In the previous episode, Osvaldo laid down the main arguments of his work on the narco narratives, especially referring to his book, Drug Cartels Do Not Exist, Narcotrafficking in U.S. and Mexican Culture. Check out that episode if you haven't already. I am your host, Noé Mendoza, PhD candidate at the Department of International Environment and Development Studies of the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. And this is the Political Ecology Forum podcast at NMBU. Is the state still like a predominant actor in this story as it was in the beginning?
Well, I guess in order to for me to really begin to answer that question, I would have to first make an important claim that I set forth in both of my books, and it is that the history of the drug trade as a phenomenon is one thing, right? That can be and should be studied, of course, and it has been studied, you know. From multiple perspectives and fields, right? From journalism to history to sociology, there are plenty of great works out there tracing or attempting to trace the history of the drug trade in Mexico, right? I recommend, for example, the work of sociologist Luis Astorga, or more recently, the archival research done by historian Benjamin Smith in a recent book called The Dope, that is also very, very interesting. But so that's at the first level of understanding what the drug trade is and what it amounts to in history, in particular from the early 20th century and on. But then there's a second debate that I believe should be separated from the history of the drug trade, which is the history of the drug war, right? And we tend to conflate those two ideas, right? We tend to make them equal or somewhat explanatory in consequence or in causality, right? So the drug trade does not trigger the drug war, right? The drug war has a very different genealogy, a very different history, a very different political trace in Mexico. And this history relates not so much to the production of narcotics, but to the idea of national security. And how, especially from the late 1940s and on, the United States began pushing or rearranging its own security apparatus after the Second World War, into creating this discourse that would deploy the idea of a common enemy across continents and territorially and extraterritorially. For the U.S. intervention and hegemony to deploy, right? And so since the 1940s, the idea of this enemy that is of transnational nature that must be fought in cooperation with friendly governments across the hemisphere has prevailed and motivated and it has in fact driven U.S. geopolitical interventionism. And so from 1940s and 1940s and on, we had a series of enemies crafted by this agenda of national security. The first and foremost, of course, is the idea of global communism as a threat, the common threat, not just for U.S. national security, but of course, as it was then accepted by friendly governments in Mexico and then, of course, after the 1970s in countries like Chile or Argentina. And that made countries like Nicaragua, the place of dispute for the Cold War. But at the mid of the 1980s, there was a paradigm shift that displaced the idea of global communism as the central object of this national security agenda, and the narco appeared to fulfill that justification or that role, right? So in 1986, President Ronald Reagan designated then the drug trade and the drug business in Latin America as the new common national security threat, right? And from that decade and on, our history of the what we call the drug war took a very radical turn, right? We started talking about the drug trade as the new enemy, transnational enemy, that could only be really confronted militarily and by creating a very powerful, ever-expanding security apparatus that not only grew, for example, the size of the army of or the Mexican Marines, but actually began the process of militarization of state and local police forces. And so what we have is throughout the 1990s and on, an ongoing permanent process of militarization that instigated a mentality of war, or what Michel Foucault would call a global governmentality of war, that created countries like us, or pushed countries like ours into a permanent state of siege and disruption and conflict, and that has been since that decade and on only exacerbated by the continuous increase of armed forces all over the country, right? And so what you then need to understand is that the drug trade is just the justification for this new understanding of social tissue of communities in Mexico that is marked by criminality, by violence, by this idea that this organized crime has reached and amounted to new levels of destruction and corruption, and of course violence that can only be confronted through the military. So if you follow then what I'm arguing here, the drug trade has just become the signifier to justify the continuity of war and military presence. So going back to your question, before this era of militarization, the drug trade in Mexico was actually not perfectly, but in a very functional way, integrated to state structures, right? And this has been documented by plenty of academic research and journalism, showing and demonstrating how, the most significant organizations and actors in the drug trade had not only the complicit acquiescence of state structures, but were in fact instrumentalized by state actors and military institution, and of course police forces. So to the point, for example, that the most notorious drug lord of the 1980s all carried police badges, right? And our common mythology about the drug trade currently, we tend to believe that somehow they commanded the police forces, or that they exerted some disproportionate influence over state structure. But it was in fact the opposite, right? They were serving a role in a state of exception that allowed them to exist within police and military and political structures, but that had very little and very reduced capabilities of influence, right? So the agency of a trafficker is in fact very, very scarce. Even despite what, a series like Netflix Narcos would tell you, right? So the trafficker in the 1980s, let's say, was some form of an employee of the government, an informal employee of the government, and not in any way, shape, or form, an agent of force, right? And this is very easily demonstrable just simply by the mere fact that even the most notorious traffickers of that era all ended up in prison or killed, right? And very quickly, very rapidly replaced by plenty of others that were out there readily available to join these structures. Now, until the 1980s, that was true. But then what happened, as I mentioned before, is that the paradigm of national security suddenly considered them the new common enemy for national security. So they, very quickly, suddenly, they ended up being on the wrong side of history, if you will. So from being instrumental, functional part of a state structure, of state of exception, they suddenly found themselves to be the enemy of a new governmentality, of a new violent militarist rationale. And so this very quickly turned ugly for them, right? So in the late 1980s, as Mexico entered this shift into the now what we call the drug war, right? The permanent militarization and violence against the drug traffickers, consumers, and producers alike. The traffickers in Mexico were quickly disorganized and you know apprehended, and many of them are still in prison or have died in prison. And so throughout the 1990s, then you had plenty of geopolitical treaties and agreements between Mexico and the U.S. to increase the size of the military and military spending, and to just simply embrace this idea that the new logic for permanent war was to fight the drug trade. So, and this is really interesting because if you look back in history, and if you look at the work of journalists, especially from the 1980s, the trafficking, the drug trade as an issue was not really a main concern. Right. And only anachronically can we really think of it as a problem. Right. And there's plenty of work that you can look at where the trafficker actually is just, you know, it's a very marginal activity that makes the front pages only because of its pathetic and frowned upon perception in society. And this is why, for example, in the 1970s, especially, but also all the way to the 1980s, the trafficker in the public imaginary occupies a very, very humble place, right? The trafficker is not a powerful agent of destruction and chaos that we imagine today. It's actually a very humble, most likely peasant, right? Without education, that joins the ranks of those trying to achieve easy money, you know, bringing some drugs across the border, but who usually are protagonists of cautionary tales, right? Of tales telling you that, you know, you should not engage in the drug trade because things will turn awry, right? Things will not be successful, and you most likely be either betrayed or captured or killed. So that imaginary, right, that prevailed in the 1970s and the 80s, corresponded to the fact that Mexico had no real anti-drug policy that led us to believe that we were at war with the drug trade, right? But that shifted from the late 80s and especially throughout the 1990s, and suddenly that paradigm instigated a new public imaginary, right? And now, starting from the mid-1990s and over, we started to believe and accept that traffickers now were organizing in powerful groups that had this idea of a cartel that had global reach that could, you know, control state structures, you know, something that was unheard of in the 1980s, right? And that somehow amounted to so much power and control of our territory that they just needed to be fought almost like an armed insurgency, right? Almost as if they were the new guerrilla, right? The leftover from the Cold War. And so that idea, right, of the drug cartel was deliberately manufactured by U.S. institutions pushing for the drug war and creating in consequence other institutions that corresponded to that mentality. In Mexico, for example, it came to fruition with the creation of CISEN, which is the Center for Investigation and National Security, right? That was created in 1989, you know, the key year of 1989, and after Berlin Wall is falling and the idea of global communism is no longer taking hold or any relevance in the global scenario. And so national security, coded as the drug trade, became our new language, our new perception of things. And so throughout that decade, they basically started selling us, the U.S., that we needed a drug war, and we accepted it, right? Our governments made that shift and followed the U.S. lead, from the government of Carlos Salinas de Gortari in 1988 and on, to, of course, the government of Felipe Calderón that decided ultimately to deploy the military for the drug trade. So going back to your question, the role of the state has shifted from being, you know, the administrator of the, if you will, the hub or the or the main controller, the main enforcer for the state of exception and the clandestine economy that was integrated to state structures in the 70s and 80s, to making the trafficker an external enemy that had to be fought. But in this history, right, the trafficker has very little to say, right? The trafficker has consistently been the object of different understandings and policies of enforcement and security, right? So from being somehow as a cooperator or somebody who participated and collaborated in state structures, it went to become an external enemy that had to be dismantled, destroyed, apprehended, extradited, etc. So and this has been done, and this is something that I would highlight and make sure that that is clearly stated through the leadership of the U.S. and the agenda of the U.S. pushing for the new rationale of national security and the drug war in the continent. So this is not done. This is not our domestic history, right? This is the result of the transnational effort for geopolitical intervention, push from the global north into the global south, right? So this is not our single-handed history of criminality, of organized crime, of our values as a failed state that sometimes is portrayed, right? And this is not a problem created by Mexicans against Mexicans, right? But this is the byproduct of a geopolitical agenda, right, that permanently pushes countries like Mexico into war, and not just Mexico, Colombia, of course, more recently, El Salvador, for example, with massive incarceration of brown men, etc.
I would like to move to the present administration of our president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president. I think in his term, things experienced an interesting turn, because in the beginning, he radically changed the discourse on the so-called cartels. His policy, to my understanding, was not so focused on bringing down big drug lords. And it seemed that even the army was somehow ordered to hold fire in situations of open confrontation. And then I followed some of your essays in Mexican media outlets, particularly some of your articles in Proceso, the magazine Proceso. And I sensed like some sort of well-grounded optimism towards this shift in presidential discourse or the presidential narrative. But as we are approaching the end of López Obrador's presidential term, the military seems to have gained more influence in fundamental policies of the Mexican state, like migration, public security, and the levels of violence have more or less kept its previous trajectory, as far as I can see. So my question is, if cartels don't exist and the Mexican state was the original promoter of the discourse of the war on drugs, what has happened under AMLO's term? Why, if his approach to the so-called cartels allegedly changed, the army seems to be gaining more influence and the levels of violence don't shift trajectory?
It's a very important question, and one that we must tackle, even though we don't have the full privilege of historical perspective, right? Because these things are ongoing and developing as we speak. But I would say a few things. Well, first, President López Obrador came to office with a very strong, coherent critique of neoliberalism in general as a project in Mexico and even in Latin America, right? And this has plenty of ramifications, but there are two in particular that I think are important to bring to this discussion. On one side, he had a very strong critique of the military deployment for the so-called drug war. And he I believe, accurately understood that the military presence increased the violence, and that it was done not only against the poorest sectors of Mexican society, but also in service of transnational interests in Mexico, right? The business of war, the contraband of weapons, the militarization expenditures at the U.S.-Mexico border, and of course the increase in investment, public investment in the security apparatus. And once again, and I want to be very emphatic, this didn't happen just because Mexico had entanglement with corruption with the cartels, and that we needed to fight them, but rather this happened historically because of the U.S. national security agenda promoting the drug war, right? And one of the things that López Obrador has consistently said throughout his presidency now is that how is it possible that we are pushed to militarize our country in this anti-drug effort? And in the U.S., you know, the largest consumer of drugs, one of the countries that has one of the largest pernicious systems of money laundering and official corruption, there is no such militarization, right? And precisely because there is not a drug war as it is deployed in Mexico, U.S. policy by police violence mostly affects the disenfranchised and poor minorities in different parts of the country, right? But we don't have the massive presence of military forces in cities like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, where drugs are consumed in a very relaxed, free way, right? So this very dissonance, right, between how we're supposed to tackle the problem in Latin America is one of the guiding principles of his resistance, right? Of his critique of the drug war. And I believe that is completely accurate and a very important point that that I think other presidents have made too, but unsuccessfully have been able to translate into policy. So when he came to office in 2019, President López Obrador began clearly with an effort to interrupt on a discourse level, right, the drug war policy, but then also on the material level to suspend major military operations, and he had in sight the idea of even replacing the military presence in security operatives with a civil police force that he created in the first years of his government, what he called the National Guard, right, that replaced the federal police and that also incorporated elements of the Mexican armed forces. And this new force was supposed to be under civil command, right, to conduct all major security operations in Mexico, once again replacing the military. And I believe all that, at least in the very first 2 or 3 years of his presidency, had very significant effects, right? As you mentioned, the president ordered the stand down of military operations and brought to light very important questions of how previous governments had conducted basically atrocities against vulnerable people and how his government was no longer willing to do that. We saw the effect of that position in the failed operation to capture the son of El Chapo Guzman in Culiacán in 2019. When that happened, I agreed with the presidential decision to let go the trafficker, you know, a 20-something-year-old man who was involved in drug trafficking, but in the president's view, and I agree with it, does not merit the life, sacrificing the life of anyone, right, in order to capture him. Just as the U.S. makes very little effort, right, to dismantle the pernicious drug structures that circulate cocaine and methamphetamine and all kinds of other illegal drugs all over the country, right? This decision, I believe, was welcome also by most Mexicans who were fed up with the drug war narrative, and even though it seemed to cost them politically, I believe in the immediate term, it really ended up being a very favorable decision, right? So I think not only his popularity was maintained, but also I believe once again that in the immediate effect of this is to send the message that his government would not be the continuity of the killing strategy, the murderous strategy of the past governments. Now, it is true that in the last stage of his presidency, as you mentioned, something has shifted, right? And the president seems to be now favoring not only the military presence in most of the country. As we know, the military now is in control of the southern and the northern borders. It's in control of customs checkpoints, in control of the new Mexico City airport, and just simply penetrated different realms of the federal government. The president has also now seemed to allow the continuity of the drug war itself. Right. There have been plenty of other major operations happening now, including the final capture of El Chapo's son. Right. That happened not long ago with the very disproportionate military force that led to the killing of multiple people and even soldiers. And so this, of course, is very worrisome. And I do perceive then that the government, the federal government under his administration, has somehow returned to the idea of the drug war in terms of military operations. Now, I don't know exactly how to account to this shift. All I can tell you is that there's tremendous pressure from multiple sides of the drug war, multiple aspects of the drug war. For one, for example, you have, of course, U.S. pressure directly exerted into domestic discourse on the drug war, right? You have the DEA, the State Department, even at the level of the ambassador, who happens to be somebody close to López Obrador. But this is a constant point of disagreement, right? That the president must do something to act on the drug war. Then you have our own internal pressures, right? Not only from the right-wing opposition, but also from the armed forces in Mexico that are very interested in maintaining their presence in the drug war. Because as it happened, for example, in the case of Colombia, the one of the biggest beneficiaries of the drug war in Mexico has been the armed forces, right? They saw budget increases exponentially, right? Political control to exert, you know, sovereignty in multiple parts of the country. They have almost unaccountable administration and control of the New Mexico City International Airport, right? They literally reap the profits from the airport and keep them to themselves, right? And of course, they do all this with a high degree of impunity, right? And so under the logic of the drug war, of course, the Mexican armed forces can always claim some form of exception, right, of emergency, of contingency, where all this the negative aspects of their presence has to be underscored or for the moment suspended because we're at a moment of war, right? And so if you then see the international panorama, you have multiple actors and institutions playing their own presence and influence over the decision of continuing the drug war. At the same time, and this is something we didn't really touch on this interview, but the president has been very vocal in trying to counter the energy reform and the energy extraction projects that have been happening, especially since the 2000s all over Mexico. So he's been trying to renegotiate several aspects of energy contracts and companies' presence in multiple parts of Mexico, right? From the state of Monterrey, Nuevo León, in Michoacán, in the Gulf of Mexico, plenty of transnational agreements have been revoked or at least revised. And there's plenty of opposition about that, especially, for example, even the electricity sector, right, where he managed to increase public participation in the distribution of electricity, and that caused major problems. So as we have explained, the energy discussion and the energy debate has been simultaneous to the drug war. And so it's not just the idea that he's suspending or reducing the army presence or try to reduce army presence in drug operations, but at the same time he's trying to undo energy reform and energy contracts from the previous governments. So those two processes ongoing simultaneously, of course, are very, very difficult and very tense, intentioned with geopolitical forces. And so it is very difficult for his government to navigate those two fronts, if you will, without all the extraordinary pressure and influence from multiple actors. Now, what I would say, however, even though I'm no longer, you know, that optimist as I was in the first half of his government, is that the president continues to have a clear sense, a clear historical sense of U.S. presence in Mexico. And he has put into question the presence of agencies like the DEA, the State Department, and diplomacy altogether. And he has managed to at least contain some of the most pernicious effects of the drug war, right? So he has able to demand a more close fiscalization and surveillance of DEA agents in Mexico. He has refused to engage in just continuous violent use of the military forces to tackle pretty much any operation or drug related operation. And I believe, you know, to some degree, that has been very important and significant. And as he does this, I believe he's also, you know, making the public aware, right, of the extreme need to question the drug war narrative, to look at the U.S. as a source of a lot of the incoming problems related to the drug trade, right? The fact that, you know, they're the largest drug consumer, the fact that they money laundered, you know, in disproportionate ways, you know, incomparable to Mexico, and of course the pernicious gun trade, the illegal gun contraband, right, that brings hundreds of thousands of weapons annually into Mexico. They even filed a lawsuit against arm manufacturers in the U.S. So there are many positive aspects, but yes, in general, I do see that his government has, adjusted or in the end accepted the global trend of militarization that we are seeing all over the global South. And in this, I would like to say, you know, perhaps my final perspective on this whole thing, right? Which is that this is not the militarization of the country happens to be in the name of the drug trade, but in reality, it's a global pattern, right? That is affecting not only our hemisphere, but the entire planet. But it happens under different names and different signifiers all across the globe, right? It happens for us in the name of drugs, but it happens because of, you know, gangs in El Salvador, and it has different names depending on what political national context you are visiting. And so when we look at our own question of militarization and security, we've been fed the idea that we're fighting the drug trade. And as we began this conversation, I argue that is really just in many ways a myth. But the U.S. security agenda keeps shifting that signifier for us. And so the government of López Obrador is not just deploying the military to fight the so-called cartels, but it's also doing it to contain undocumented migration, right? And this is happening in consistent collaboration with the U.S. governmentality against the global movement of peoples, right? And so as they do it, you know, they please not just, you know, the most violent agenda of the U.S. right, but also of the U.S. liberal left, right? Of the government, for example, of Joe Biden. So here, as we look and revisit and we critique the militarization of President López Obrador and his general legacy in Mexico, we must simultaneously put into question the transnational forces that bring us to this moment, right? And so here, as we look at the militarization of Mexico and state sponsored violence, then we also must keep in mind that this is happening as a direct result of U.S. intervention in Mexico, that this has happened under the guidance, the pressure, and the flat out aggression of geopolitics in Mexico, right? And that has happened consistently for decades, regardless of who's in the White House and who and what political debate is taking place, and whether this is a conservative or a liberal president. And so what you have is then that President López Obrador's anti-immigrant policy was something welcomed by the Trump administration, but also very welcome as well by the Biden administration, that has continued to express support for the militarization of the country in that respect. So this is a complex situation that, once again, is not just confined to the question of the drug trade and whether the president has the will or not to end the anti-drug policies, but in fact the result and the consequence of a global mentality that militarizes multiple aspects of contemporary society, right? So as we are still, unfortunately, fighting the drug war, we are also fighting a war against migrants, right? Against people of color moving across the continent, and we are instigating a mentality of violence and war on many other aspects of civil society, right? So we have now that under the question of the drug trade and the drug cartel, we are also talking about human trafficking, human smuggling. We're talking about the traffic of avocado, right? We're talking about land dispossession. We're talking about kidnapping and extortion. So the narco nowadays is an empty signifier, right, that can be easily accommodated to pretty much any degree of criminality that official discourse wants to assess it, right? So we say commonly that Mexico's fighting a drug war, but what really is happening is that we're experiencing the continuous presence of a military operation that is exerting different forms of social control, of violence, administering the violence for multiple objectives, including those of, as we mentioned today here, land dispossession, extraction of energy and resources, the control of the population, and even the interrupting the flow of migration. So once again, we are not alone doing this to ourselves, but we are the direct result of a global geopolitical trend, right, that affects not just our country, but, you know, everyone in the hemisphere.
And Osvaldo, I want to thank you so much for your time, for sharing with our audience your insights. I invite the people listening to this podcast to read Osvaldo's work in English and Spanish. I will put the references in the description of the podcast. And thank you so much, Osvaldo.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to speak with you and to engage in this conversation with our colleagues from the other side of the globe. Thank you for having me.
This is the Political Ecology Forum podcast at NMBU.